Okay, we're back. We're, you know, restroom break, refill. Although it's not necessarily a refill since we still have this much left in this
one. I'm going to pretend mine's all gone.
And this one here. I'm just going to push it up. So, Chris, you did a good job of picking beers because the first one, which was a 7% brown.
Yes, it was.
And this, the dude's double trunk, which is a double IPA, 10.8, I believe is what it says.
Go big or go home is what I like to say. Everything's bigger in Texas. Yeehaw.
Well, yeehaw.
There we
go. This is, that is giant. I'm trying to think of maybe Moylan's Hopsicle comes in close, but I think that's still like 9%, 9.5%.
The Ruin 10 kind of comes into that, doesn't it?
Does it?
Yeah.
So I have, as homebrew, I've gone, I wanted to see if I could break the 13% mark, and I did. And it was okay, but it wasn't, but it was, okay. but like the 9.5 to 10% is a sweet spot. Otherwise, there's just way too much sugar in it.
I will say most beers I've had that have been over 10%, you can really taste alcohol, and it changes the beer almost like a barley wine kind of consistency, where you're trying a beer that's like either overly sweet or it's gonna have to have something else to really mask it. But with this IPA, it's like, it tastes, I mean, it has an incredible taste to it that, that you cannot taste alcohol in it, which would be really dangerous if you're sitting down to drink this and you think, hey, it's a really good IPA, and suddenly you're drinking a 10.5%, you know, double here.
Yeah, so one of the terms that beer people, like the super uber geeks, they hate the word dank, okay?
Dank,
but This is what I call dank. I mean, the aroma coming off of this is so green in hop that it's crazy.
It has an incredible.
It is. It smells really good. This does what a double IPA is supposed to do too. A lot of times when I'm introducing somebody to a beer, and this was just kind of like, this was one of these happenstance kind of things where this is what I had, somebody decided to drink it, and because it was a homebrew, oh, I really like this. And but these people are claiming that they're not craft beer drinkers, like they want the Bud Lights, they want the Miller Lights. You give them a double IPA, one that's a well balanced one, so there's plenty of bitterness, but then there's a lot of sweetness with it as well. People love it, and it's because it's one of those things, go big or go home. And I think it is so unlike anything that they've ever tasted before that that's why. But there are some double IPAs where it's almost one-sided hop. It's like a hop juice, and I don't care for that. You know, I want the malt backbone.
There's been a couple that I've liked in that regard. For instance, Golden Road's Wolf Among Weeds. I really like the IPA. I think it has, you know, the hop characteristic way up front, but I think it is very nice. A really good double IPA to introduce people to is the Firestone Double Jack, which is, you know, it's a nice balance of sweetness, nice balance of hoppiness, and I gave that to a friend of mine who doesn't like beer at all, and he absolutely loved it. So it's very interesting to see the sweetness play like a big part in an IPA of all things.
That one might be 10% too.
Yeah, it's close to it. You know.
So yeah. Union Jack was when we were moving into this house, there's a market just down the street. And so I went to go get some Subway for the mover guys, and I came back with a six-pack of DBA and a six-pack of Union Jack. And the Union Jack was the second beer that I had after we had moved in, started moving in at 8 o'clock that morning. Fantastic. I was expecting an English pale ale IPA because of the name Union Jack,
right,
and was pleasantly surprised by that. And then when I saw the Double Jack, then it just...
The Double Jack was something else.
Right.
I also like the Wookiee Jack. The Wookiee Jack's nice.
Yeah, so if you want... one of the things with Wookiee Jack, my favorite pairings is just a spoonful of peanut butter. That's all you need. They're just fantastic.
Because
nice. There's some coffee, roasty...
Are you pregnant?
Bitter, no, bitter chocolate. I don't think I am. Maybe I am. I better start watching what I'm drinking. Bitter chocolate, coffee, the rye, you know, there's a little bit of sweetness.
I can see that.
It is way better than a Reese's peanut butter cup, which is my all-time favorite candy bar. If I'm ever going to eat a candy bar, that's the one I'm. This is way better than that. Hey, you put your peanut butter in my Wookiee Jack. Hey, you put your Wookiee Jack in my peanut butter. What is it? So try it. But don't go highbrow.
No highbrow peanut butter.
No. Because you need the peanut butter that has some sugar in it. Right. So don't go get the organic stuff. You just stick with Jif or Skippy. You'll be fine.
You might lose a tooth or two, but it's going to be totally worth it, right?
It will be. Right. Teeth rotted out, whatever. I don't know if you're going to suck on it forever. But
yeah, there you go.
It should be okay.
So, yeah, I mean, these two dudes, you know, brewers are going to be awesome. I'm taking both of them over to the UK. I have, I've made friends with the guys over there who are just in love with, you know, whatever I bring. Last time I brought Wolf Among... Well, actually, no, I'm sorry. My fiance brought the Wolf Among Weeds. I'm from Golden Road back home with her. We were in San Diego and went to the Best Damn Beer Shop, so it was called, and it was pretty fantastic. What's up with the can?
Oh, I'm just reading it, looking through it, and because there's something on the elephant's foot, and it says something ale, but I cannot... India Pale. I see. Okay, there we go. Mm.
It's
taking a while for this for the whole can design to set in. I mean,
I know.
An elephant with what? What is the what is that? What's the Taj Mahal? It's all starting to make sense to me now.
You know, I'm loving the fact that these are in cans. Also, people used to look at cans and think, "Wow, cheap beer." But now it's like you got Oscar Blues and you got, you know, the dudes, and you got New Belgium doing can stuff. So, I mean, there's some really good finds in cans, and they actually keep the beer better, especially if it's an IPA. No light's getting into that at all. So,
yeah, I am the can. I've bought into the hype.
Mm-hmm.
The can is a superior packaging for beer, and the, you know, when you're looking at 12 ounces of beer in a bottle, the bottle is a heavy container to carry that around in, you know, and then when you pick up a can of beer, you're basically lifting up the weight of the beer. And so you know there isn't any added weight or very little added weight with the packaging.
I will say I have just packed my baggage to go. I'm leaving on Thursday, and I have 6 bottles, 22-ounce bottles in my bag, the 22-ounce sizes, and it was 38 pounds, I think, when I had packed most of my clothes and stuff in there, too. And I'm thinking, Jesus, this is going to be heavy if I put the cans in there. And I tried it with the cans, and it added like a pound and a half.
There you go.
So it wasn't bad. But let's not also forget, this is a 10.5% beer in a 16-ounce can. So <it's,
laughs> they were going big on this one, too.
They're going big on that. So it's not just, you know, here's a little, you know, a little 12-ounce pour or whatever. This is the full Monty here. It's good if you're going to be at home for a while.
Well, I've got cans all over the place too, and if I have a choice between the bottled version and the canned version, I'm always going to get the canned mm-hmm. version. They're just stacking in the fridge, whatever it is. It's all there. There used to be some concern with when they were filling it, and because the surface area is much larger at the top as opposed to a bottle, that there was, if they weren't very careful, that it could oxidize. And but they've solved that. They figured it out, and you know they're back filled with CO2 just the way the bottles are. And so any of the whatever people are saying about the quality control that's coming from a can, you know, just know that they're reading old articles from WikiHow or mm-hmm. whatever.
You have to be careful, though. I mean, going camping, it's the best thing to bring, cans. But like I said, you pick up one of these 4-packs, and you're thinking, hey, it's in a can, what can go wrong? And you're out at 1 p.m., and your friends are having fun. So just be careful what you're picking up now that everybody's doing cans.
Right, I just pick it up thinking that it's a 4% beer. And then
exactly.
L.A. is starting to come into itself with beer, mm-hmm. you know? And every time, now it seems like you turn around, you open up the paper, there's a new brewery.
Mm-hmm.
And being new to the area, I don't necessarily understand the difference between Torrance and L.A. or Santa Monica or whatever. But, I mean, just the greater L.A. area. We talked about the dudes. We've got Golden Road.
Mm-hmm.
Angel City just opened up. And I actually was down by that place, I don't know, 6-7 months ago. I can't. We were walking by, and I knew that this is where the place was at, and it used to be an old manufacturing building. So the train, when it went through LA, went right through it, basically right in front of it. Mm-hmm. This company made the cables that are that they use on suspension bridges. So the cables that are on the Golden Gate came from this company here. Wow. So they would the railroad would go right through it. So, you know, they're I don't want to say, I suppose in a way they're gentrifying these old neighborhoods. But when I was walking through there, it was I'm like, God, this is kind of an odd place for a brewery. You know, I don't know if, not knowing my way and necessarily where I was in LA too, you know, I was just kind of with some people and thinking, yeah, this is kind of a, it seems like a weird spot, but they have totally gutted the place. Wow. And the inlaid floors and everything else. And so, you know, just turning kind of like what's happening in Camarillo, although it's industrial complex circa 1992 maybe, right. I don't know. This is industrial complex 1880 kind of right. thing. You know what I mean? So, I mean, these huge old buildings that are just perfect for driving big machinery in and building. So we've got those three. I'm trying to think. Oh, Eagle Rock.
Eagle Rock.
And, you know, I'm missing so many. I know I am.
There's
but
quite a few. I mean, there's quite a few brew pubs I know of. Like, I think one is called Blue Palms. Am I right? Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yep, yeah. Yep. That one is. That one's got this cult following, too, yeah. That super popular.
Pasadena has a few different places, too, from what I've heard. It's been a long time since I've been able to get out to L.A., but it's nice to know that that's happening there because it's going to happen, you know, up here. Mm-hmm. What happens in L.A. happens in Ventura eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And L.A. took a while to get into the craft brewer scene. San Diego moved up to L.A. and now it's moving right. to Ventura.
Yeah,
it's
it going to
happen.
The San Diego breweries had to move into Orange County and then all the Orange County mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden Orange County is, and then you just keep
exactly.
Well, the I'm trying to think of, so one of place that people may not be familiar with, though, is the Four Point Sheridan LAX.
Mm-hmm.
And just so that everyone, full disclosure, is I'm on the beer board at that hotel. And really? So one of the things about Four Points Sheridan's is that they try to carry the craft beer from just craft beer in general.
Mm-hmm.
But they always try to have a selection of whatever's local. So they have, it's not a huge tap selection. It might be in the neighborhood of like 15 taps, all fantastic beers. But then in the summertime, they end up, they've got a poolside bar. And then on that one, which has another 10 taps, is all regional. So
wow.
as you're, you know, staying over, you've got a layover, whatever it is. But they also do beer dinners once a month generally there too. And so you can go in, pay $30, you drink the beer, you know, you're sitting by the pool. It seems weird. I mean, especially for anyone who's driven through that complex right around LAX, like, why would I want it? Well, now there's,
now you know,
if you've got an early flight, you go in the night before, you stay there and, you know, drink yourself into a happy place, go to bed and get back on the plane. Or, you know, you wake up, drink yourself into a happy place and then get on the plane. Whatever works for you.
My flight leaves at 7:15 in the morning on Thursday. I have to show up at 5 a.m. maybe do that.
Yeah.
And hang out at the Hilton for a little bit and get on my flight. That kind of idea is what I like about Bar Rincon and the Whole Foods here in Oxnard. All of their beers are local. Mm-hmm. And I like to see the board they have that says the distance, you know, from certain breweries.
I have not been in there yet.
You need to go. It's awesome. They have, I think they expanded their tap list. Because when I was in there the other day, not only did they have the ones, you know, just on their tap or whatever, but they had a board with more taps. Like I said, this is what we also have. And they're pretty much all, like, regional, local. Okay, so it was pretty nice to see. I had the, when I met you at Barrel House the other day, they had the Wolf Creek Pumpkin Vice on tap there, which was really nice. I enjoyed it. So it's really nice to see that kind of thing, you know, happening. With Ventura, it's just nice.
Well, and just as a side note, that anyone who follows me or anything knows that I'm not a fan of pumpkin beers. But, however, that said, the Pumpkin Vice is a really great beer.
It was and, really nice.
And combining the banana and the clove and the pumpkin, it all works really well.
I was really surprised by it because I didn't try it when we were at Barrel House. So that my first chance was there, and the guy tells me, he's like, yeah, first thing you're going to get is the banana and the clove, and then you'll get the pumpkin, like banana and the clove and a pumpkin beer, which, you know, I was like, what? So I tried it, and I'm thinking, this is great. Mm-hmm. This is how a pumpkin beer should be. Mm-hmm. I will admit to being a fan of pumpkin beers, but only the...
No, I don't mind anyone else being, I'm just not a fan.
No, now you're judging me, I get it. I recently bought the, oh God, what is it called? From Crooked Line, they went to their pumpkin, Imperial Pumpkin. Okay. That was really good. It was a bourbon barrel age and everything. Very nice. I bought Treat from Midnight Sun, which is their Imperial Chocolate Pumpkin Porter. And I got the Epic Brewing Fermentation Without Representation Pumpkin Porter, which I'm taking all over to the UK. So that's going to be fun. And they don't know what a pumpkin beer is over there. So I'm going to give them the good stuff before they come over and see, hey, the pumpkin beers are ubiquitous. And they all taste like bad lagers. So,
right. Well, as you're talking about that, I was thinking I should look to see are pumpkins indigenous to North America? Because whenever I think of a pumpkin, I certainly do not think of anywhere else except for North America.
I thought the same thing, but not necessarily. I think they're Asian. Oh. And when South Korea used pumpkin for a lot of their like stews and stuff. And they don't look like our typical orange pumpkin, but they call them pumpkins. So it's just a variety of squash.
All right.
Now, I'm not an expert on squash or gourds or anything, but I think, yeah, they might be Asian. I could, you know, if anybody's watching, we'll probably correct us on that. So,
right. Well, we'll
they have Google at their hand.
If in fact that segment makes it into the finished, then I will look up.
Look up the pumpkin and then like put a little note on right. The side.
An asterisk to all of the footnotes. By the way, pumpkins do grow in other places than the United States. What? There's other places than the United States?
Well, that's news to me, man.
I don't know about that.
But, yeah, let me give a little insight of what's going to happen with our reporter issue on beer.
Sounds
on
good.
The 24th. We got a guy who is a home brewer, and he knows everything there is to know about beer. The details, you know, the methods and the dirty work that I couldn't even get into. He's doing a big write-up on local places and local beer happening, and this kind of what we've been talking about. I'm going to do a story on basically yourself and podcasting and talking about, you know, sensory evaluation when it comes to beer and wine and other things when you're doing just audible, auditory stuff, which is kind of difficult. I mean, I could tell you this smells like, you know, vanilla to me or something, but I mean, if you're at home, you're thinking, that's interesting, you know. Unless you try it yourself, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. We're going to do the collaboration podcast for the same day release of The Reporter.
Yeah, I think I was thinking about your comment about how you explain these things. And other than the color, which is something that everyone can share, the aroma, the flavor, the mouthfeel, and all those are all personal variables. And so when you're on a podcast and you're explaining it, you know, you preface everything with saying, you know, your mileage may vary kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But then when you have two people who are talking about it and each person has a different sense memory, then you're all of a sudden you're almost exponentially opening up the field for people to kind of draw their connections to it. And, you're going to have to drink the beer to try it, and you're going to have to kind of do your own homework, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to have to taste it and kind of pay attention to what's happening. But if it was just me, then it might be more difficult. But since there's several other people or another person in the podcast alone, talking about what they taste, it helps people draw the conclusions. And just being able to talk about food items that are most common. And so sometimes that's really hard to find a food item that's common. But that's why in the Pints and Pairings podcast that I have Jason, who is a he's a foodie, and he has lots of experience with different foods, so that helps out a lot. And then that can spur me into other memories or other food items that I think that might taste well mm-hmm. with the beers in addition to it. But it's just, you know, those collaborations are what help kind of bring it alive and make sure that everyone has some sort of frame of reference to work with.
And that's all you can do. When I'm sitting there writing a story, I can think about a multitude of ways to say how this tastes or mm-hmm. what this, you know, smells like. And when you're doing your podcast, you have to kind of, you know, talk about it live and say, this is what I thought about it, or go back in and insert certain words mm-hmm. to whatever you want to add to it. But at the end of the day, it's going to be your user experience. And like you said, my mileage may vary. And we all experience beer in a different way. So, and wine and spirits, and as with all things in life. So that's the beauty of it, I think.
Yeah, and when you come from it as one of the terms we like to use is suggestioneers, mm-hmm. and so another made-up word for us, but using that helps to take the air of this is the way that you're supposed to taste it, or this is the only right way to taste mm-hmm. it. And saying that we understand that you may have another experience when you taste it. You may have other experiences with other foods that will help draw other connections. But then calling ourselves suggestioneers as opposed to gurus or experts or anything else, knowing that I've learned more about beer flavors and tastes and perceptions from people who don't have a beer vocabulary mm-hmm. and people who are comfortable talking to me about beer. So they may come to me with, they come to me with a completely different set of experiences, and especially with non-beer people, they try, I'm always comparing this, my beers to other beers that I've tasted or what I know about. Those people who are not beer drinkers, they don't have that experience, and so then they draw conclusions to a much broader range of foods or flavors that I just mm-hmm. don't have, or that I'm not open to, I should say.
I was once at a Southern Wine and Spirits a tasting for the BevMo employees, and we tried this, I believe it was a Cabernet, and to me, it reminded me of a chocolate cassis donut I had once, and I said that. I'm like, this reminds me of a chocolate cake donut I had with a cassis glaze. And they're like, that's very interesting. Like, sit down now. I'm like, no, that's what it tasted like to me.
Yeah, and you know, that's, I learned early on when I thought I was an expert at beer pairings, and somebody who was not said, you know, you should try these pairings. You should try this the way that the chef wanted, whatever. No, I'm the expert. I know I should be drinking this beer with this meal. Mm-hmm. And I tried the other one, and it was fantastic, and it opened me up to anyone who has tasted these beers or their sensories are just as valid as mine, and that I may learn something, and because these people are so open, they don't have any boundaries around the beer world. They're not bound by any of those constraints, that I can learn something from them. And so it was a humbling and freeing moment at that point to say, hey, yeah, don't take yourself seriously. Nobody wants to, you know, the last thing the world needs is a pretentious beer prick. And so, you know, that's just not what we need. And so it was a very good learning moment, I guess.
My goal has always been to not be as much of a snob as many of my wine customers were. I don't like to say, well, that's bad, or that's crap, you shouldn't like it. It's just like, hey, if you like that, you should try this. It's my best way to, you know, get somebody away from trying something that I think it was personally not good. And as much as I love, you know, Firestone and everything, like, I am not a huge fan of the 805. Right? My friends are. They love the 805. I'm like, hey, try this one too. You know, Firestone makes another really good, you know, beer, the Summer Solstice. While that's out, try that one. I don't say anything negative about the beer. I want, because if you do say, start saying negative things, people think you're insulting them personally.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do you mean? My taste is bad and yours is better, you know? So you play that game, but beer shouldn't be about snobbery. You know, it shouldn't be about, you know, what's better per se as to what you like taste preference-wise. And if somebody tells you that you're wrong, it's a bad beer, then you shouldn't be talking to that person because that person needs, like, you know, some help with their social skills.
Well, that's, you know, I wrote, when I first started writing my website, Hophead Said, I was doing a lot of beer reviews. And then I started doing Google searches on beer reviews, and there is about 1 billion people who do beer reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, okay, so what do I need to do? Well, I can look at these beers, and no matter what kind of beer it is, whether I like the style or not, or I care for the style or appreciate it, I can still find foods that pair with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of the thing, that if this is what you like, you know, this particular beer, brand, style, whatever it is, then I can help you find a food that will help accentuate it. And so instead of criticizing the beer or judging the beer, using the beer's flavor profiles and finding something that will help accentuate it or magnify it, whatever it is, but ultimately just to raise the drinker's enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
Should we try the next one?
Yeah,
I'll pull that next beer out.
Why not? So the next one I brought was the from the brewery, which is in the OC. Now, I have some friends who live like about 5 minutes away from the brewery, which is incredibly, you know, I'm super jealous. The brewery, to me, is one of the most innovative breweries we have in the States. And them and Cascade from Oregon are some of my favorite, like, if you want to try something new, you want to go to the brewery. Today I brought along the, let's see, I'll wait for you to get back over here, Will.
That's all right, go ahead.
Today I brought along is the Mother Funker. This is a sour blonde ale aged in oak barrels. It's not 10.5%. It is not 8%. I believe it's only around 6, maybe even if that. Yeah, it's 6%. So it's now my very first like actual beer fest was Stone's Sour Fest, the one in Escondido. I went with my fiance Becky and we had the greatest time, and sours, you know, are making their own impression now on American palates. And I was just incredibly pleased by just about everything. And let's see how well this beer lasted under my bed and my wine thing. This one seems like one we're going to have to, like work our way through. To me, I mean, on the nose, I smell apricots, like, first and foremost. Some lemon, obviously. I mean, you get that, it's that citrus, okay? It really kicks you in the face.
Well, underneath is horse blanket. If you've ever been on a barn, been in on a farm, if you've mm-hmm. walked through a barn, you know the smell of animals, and specifically...
Barnyard is what we used to call it.
Barnyard.
In the industry, yeah.
Yeah, I think horse blanket is a tough one if you've never been around horses. So mm-hmm. you don't have that... But that is what, I don't know, horse sweat
it smells
like. But one of the things, one of the things, you know, when you talk about that is, talk about these flavors, is there are certain flavors, like horse blanket, that don't sound very, it doesn't sound very appealing. There are some cat pee aromas, there are some other things,
mm-hmm.
but with everything rolled together and... somehow they all work, and if any one of them was in or out, you know, a degree, then maybe it'd be less pleasant.
Well, I'll compare it to something like a nice wine I had once. It had a barnyard aroma to it, and that is the very earthy quality to it. You get a lot of hay, mm-hmm. maybe even like, and this is going to sound weird, we're talking about like drinks, but like, you know, the leavings, I guess you could say. And the reason why is because it has an earthiness to it. Now, earthiness really pops fruitiness, okay? So if you have something like, for instance, has a dark cherry aroma to it, but also the hint of barnyard in the back of it on a wine, you're going to get like a savory quality from it. It's almost like getting into an orchard and just putting your face right in a cherry, you know, tree or whatever, and giving it a good whiff, which I've never done. But, you know, I imagine that's what it would smell like. Now, this is an interesting beer. Sours are always interesting to try. And it's very hard to find one, I think, domestically made that tastes like this. This tastes like some of the ones I've had from, like, you know, Belgium and whatever. This is pretty good stuff.
Yeah, I would say, too, this would be... So, you know, looking at styles, you've got sour styles. There's the lambics, there's Gueuze, there's Flanders Red, there's all these that have these European bases. And then when you come to American beers, if you see the term wild ale, a lot of times you're going to be finding a lot of those similar flavors in it. They can't call it lambic because lambic is appellation, and that has to be in whatever region it's around, Brussels. And then Flanders, obviously, because Flanders. But although people here don't necessarily pay attention to that, and they can call them Flanders Reds, yeah, whatever. But this is, you know, it's an incredible hay golden color, and this would be, and I'm trying to think of any of a number of beers that I've had Belgian that have this kind of color and this kind of flavor and complexity to them.
It finishes like a lemon candy to me. It's just, you have that sour kick but without the sweetness.
It is. It's really nice.
Yeah.
And it's like, I was looking at for the ABV.
It's 6%, yeah.
And so ABV on sours too are generally a little lower. But
we say that, but when I was at the Stone Sour Fest, I swear everything I picked was 9 to 10%. And these were the darker ones, so.
American Wild Ales?
No. Maybe. There was a couple that I had that were collaborations with some European brewers. Cantillon, though, when I went to Cantillon, we did pick up their Syrah barrel-aged lambic, and that was about 4%. That was interesting. Honestly, sours for me, I love them. When the brewery, for instance, did the tap takeover at Barrel House 101 here in Ventura, they had the Tart of Darkness, their Flanders Red, got to try all of those, and this was actually a gift to me from one of my good friends who live in the OC, who live right next to the brewery. I'm also taking over a bottle of white chocolate to the UK, so that ought to be interesting.
Yeah, those ones that have a slight sour to them, they also have a massive malt bill. You know, and you look at what made these beers sour was just that they were made from wheat, first of all, which has a certain amount of tartness to it, but then the open fermentation, and they were just brewed as a regular beer, you know, a regular strength beer. There wasn't anything special about it, in that it, they were trying to make a 10% beer. And so, you know, you look at a lot of those samples that are in a moderate range, the 4 to you know, maybe 5 or 6%, but you look at some of the ones that people might be the most familiar with, Lindemann's, and you know, that have a lot of syrup in it to balance the tartness. You know, you look at, try and find those, and I'm trying to remember what it was, but those ones are low. Those are in like the 2% range. You know, it's like a soda.
I haven't found a lambic over here that tastes anything like the ones I've had over there. When in Brussels, there was the Mort Subite, I think is what it is. The we went to that cafe and had their Gerza. You know the proper pronunciation.
Well, I hear it pronounced differently.
I've always said Gerza. This is because, I don't know, that's the way I look at it. I had that there, and it was just like a big wallop of sour. You know, and they blended it with some other stuff, and a Cantillon, same thing. I mean, the sour, there was none of that sweet kick at the end of it that like Americans tend to really want in that kind of thing. And this is like, hey, if you're gonna drink this, you're gonna treat it more like a Sauvignon Blanc than you would a beer, because that's the kind of profile you're gonna get off of it. In other words, if you want to do a good pairing with a lambic, an actual true lambic like the ones, you know, Cantillon or whatever, you would pair them with like a nice whitefish, or something with a nice chicken, you wouldn't pair them like you would a normal beer. You would say, this is going to go with lighter fare, or this is going to go with something that's going to accentuate that sourness and not, you know, or accentuate the fruitiness rather than just the simple sourness of it.
Mm-hmm.
At Barrel House, they had the Mort Subite Lambic on once, and I thought, hey, it's the real deal. But for whatever reason, that beer was sweet. Like, it didn't it was like their peach Lambic, and it was sweet. The one I had over there, it wasn't sweet at all. So obviously they changed it for the American audience. But if you want to try some legitimate like sours that are the ones that, you know, go back to the roots, something like this is probably the closest you're going to get out here. I would also, have you heard of Cascade from Oregon? They're good mm-hmm. stuff too, and they make some nice sours. I was very impressed with a lot of the stuff I tried.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of other sours up and down the coast here in California too. So I mean, Russian River,
of course.
And I've had, certainly a handful of their beers. The brewery out here, and you know, this is a gem for us because I don't know if they even have enough production capacity to serve Orange County, much less anything that's outside of California. So you're gonna have to come out here probably to get these beers,
or trade to somebody who's willing to get something up. They have the their subscriber thing you can do where you get like four, you get an option to buy four bottles a month or something like that,
mm-hmm.
or maybe quarterly, but. They make some good stuff. They had the horchata. That one was interesting. That was an interesting beer.
Yeah, if you like horchata, then I think you will like that beer. Mm-hmm. If you don't care for horchata, then...
You might want to move away.
You might want to move away.
The other reason why I brought this beer was because this is one of the breweries that's making a way into Ventura now. You can find them mm-hmm. in Trader Joe's out here. Just yesterday when I stopped by Trader Joe's, Saison Rue, The Mischief and the Autumn Maple were all there available in bottles. But Whole Foods, not to keep talking about Whole mm-hmm. Foods, but in their cold case, they had the Boys, their anniversary beer.
The wood beer.
They had the White Oak. They had all kinds of stuff, you know, from the brewery. And now you're seeing it on tap down here, too. So that's a really good sign for Ventura mm-hmm. that you're actually getting, you know, that kind of stuff up here from OC. And now I don't have to beg my friend to buy me a $30 beer and then get reimbursed on it.
Yeah, so the Bois or the Boys, whatever it is.
I have to say Boys. Like, I'm going to go have one of the Boys.
They use the, and you can probably help me out with the pronunciation on this, the Solari method, where they fill up the one cask or their barrel and then they drain that into the next one, and so then it's a continual blend. Mm-hmm. So that fifth anniversary, which it means wood, which is the Bois and the fifth anniversary. This is a blend of all five of those beers. And so what is so great about being able to drink that beer is once it's gone, you'll never get it again. And because it's always being blended in with another beer. And so, you know, up through whatever they do, through their 20th anniversary, 30th anniversary, 50th, it's going to be a huge... It's going to take, I mean...
it was incredible. I mean, just that beer itself, I mean, if that's only the fifth, right, and they're going through the 20th, right, I cannot wait to see what that 20th tastes
like. Yeah, that was by far the beer that stood out over that. Plus, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 14% or 18%.
Yeah, it was 14% that they poured 5 ounces, right? It was 5 ounces for like $10 or something like that, which makes sense for what it is,
right.
It took a while to drink it. That's because it was so, you know, big, and it was just like, that's a sipping beer. That's something, you know, I have a friend who is a big Scotch drinker, and we've argued back and forth that you can't drink beer like you can Scotch. You sit with a glass of Scotch and you sip at it. I'm like, I bet I can show you some beers you can sip at for, you know, an hour or so. And the warmer they get, the better it gets.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really incredible to try something like that, and especially when you get an opportunity, go for it. You really need to. Didn't Telegraph do a sour?
So, well, Telegraph also is from Santa Barbara. They use an interesting yeast blend.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have their white or their California ale. One of them is, it's tart because they're using wheat. Mm-hmm. But then they also use this special yeast blend, which sours it a little bit too. And I'm trying to remember off the top of my head which one it is, and I can't.
Was it the Obscura? Wasn't it Obscura?
Oh, well, so then, but then they have the Obscura series, the Petite Obscura, and then some of the other ones. The Petite Obscura was a fantastic beer. That was just incredible, and they don't do it very often. But that one was, that was just incredible. But they also have one of their regular beers that comes out, and it's the Reserva, maybe. I'll have to look up on the website. But anyway, they do a couple unique yeast blends. And so if you're one of the things you want to be careful with is if you're purchasing it thinking that it's going to be Allagash White or it's going to be anything else, and you get this and it's sour, you're going to think there's something wrong with this beer. Well, that's actually how they intended it. So you want to make sure that you read the label carefully before you purchase that.
I tried to introduce one of my friends who I used to work at an olive oil store. And we every day were given out tastings of olive oil and balsamic vinegar. That's what we did. And one particular day, I was talking with beer about beer with her, and she says, "I don't like beer." I'm like, "I bet I can find you a beer you're going to like." And she had, I keep moving away from this thing. She had, she was a big fan of balsamic vinegar. And without saying anything, I said, "Let's go to the 101 Barrel House and try some stuff." And the first thing I got her was the Duchess de Bourgogne, the Flemish red sour ale. So she tried it, and of course she loved it. That was her favorite beer to that point. And now she's a big sour freak. She goes and she'll get, you know, the 750 bottles of the stuff and just loves it. If I think sours are a very good intro to people who do not like beer. They do not taste like your normal beer. They do not taste like they're not hoppy.
Well, yeah, there's no hops.
There's
no hops.
There's the only thing you're going to get is a lot of fruit, and as long as you don't taint it, because I've tainted it once on accident. I told another friend, like, "Yeah, it tastes like balsamic vinegar. You're going to love it." And then in their mind, like, "I don't want to drink balsamic vinegar." And they go try, and sure enough, that's what it tastes. And they're like, "Yeah, I don't want to drink this." But my friend, who I did not say anything ahead of time, loved it. And she's like, "This is great. It tastes like, you know, apples. And you got your balsamic in the background." So if you have a friend who is not keen on the idea, take them and get them a sour. They're going to love it. It's a very different experience for people who, you know, are kind of lay people in it.
Well, a lot of the Belgian ales too, especially if you have some that on the labels they say brewed with figs or dates or anything. So you're looking at a lot of beers that have some wine-like qualities to it, mm-hmm. and especially if you're introducing a wine person to the beer, those kinds of things can make a difference depending on what you pick. I mean, mm-hmm. if you go and pick, you know, a standard American Pilsner, then no. You got to go something, you got to go big, you've got to go something that has an incredible amount of complexity just to showcase what beer can, because, you know, these people who are coming to you saying that they only like wine, they've got a perception of beer, and you need to really blow it out. You got to get as far away from that perception as possible.
The palate is also different for people who are trying wine, you know, before beer. They're looking for different things. So if I was going from wine to beer, which I did, you know, I would look for different things than I should have been looking for. So ease them in other words. It's easier to do that than just to say, "Hey, here is the double jack. Get at this hoppy thing right now," right? But then again, that's a good one to go for too. It all depends.
I do that one for my beer friends, you know, who are already drinking beer, but definitely on the wine side. You know, in fact, I was just at Four Bricks the other day, and I brought in, let's see, what was it? Ten Commandments, Lost Abbey. So dates and raisin, figs maybe, either way, lots of stuff happening, you know, and he... Gary Stewart there, who owns the place, or one of the part owners, really loves Mondos from Surf Brewing, and they do, and so he likes lighter, less hoppy sorts of beers, and he hadn't had anything like this before, and he was blown away by the complexity that was in the beer. Well, you know, it can get there. But that's why, and I mean, that one is still on the low end of the 750s. I mean, you may be talking $12 or $15 for that. Mm-hmm. But the brewery, especially the white chocolate, you're looking at, you know, probably $35 or $40 for that 750. Bucks, you know, and you treat it like you would a wine that you were, like a $50 wine that you were going to open to. And, you know, you just have to, yeah, it may be beer and it may be carbonated, but it still deserves that sort of treatment, you know, and just go and pour it into a liter stein.
The perception of beer is changing.
Oh, yeah.
Eventually, you're going to, you know, people will be okay with spending $30 on a bottle of beer. The white chocolate I bought was $30. I bought a bottle of wine to bring over, and it's from Force of Nature out of Paso Robles, and that bottle is $20.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's arguments there that says, hey, which one took longer to make? How much effort went into these, you know, to make these products? Beer is very much undervalued. A lot of it is. However, and not as much as it has coffee. Coffee, you know, on if you want to talk undervalued, mm-hmm. talk coffee, $1.50 for a cup, you know, people die for, is very different from talking about beer and from talking about wine. So it's interesting to see the perceptions change, and when the perceptions change, I think you'll see more often than not people being okay with paying $20 for a bottle of wine or a bottle of beer like they do with wine.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Yeah, and
it's a special occasion kind of thing.
It is, right. This isn't something that we're drinking, you know.
Now, I brought this out because this is a special
this
occasion.
This is a special occasion. Okay. Woo,
This is, I totally see in the future, you know, people with the wine cellar are going to have a beer cellar.
Oh, sure.
You know, they'll have beers that are special and say, hey, this is the day of my daughter's wedding or something, and pull out a bottle of something.
Yeah, those are you know, there's plenty of people who have, especially with Firestone Walker and everything, you know, and any other brewery that's doing anniversary beers, mm-hmm. you know, if those beers were built to age, that they're buying 3, 4, 5 a case of it, whatever it is, and then putting mm-hmm. them away, and then at some point bringing out the vertical. Well, and even, I mean, I have, this is insulated, so it keeps it,
this is your beer closet
my beer closet right here, and it keeps it from...
Makes sense. It says beer on it.
And it's insulated, so it protects it from the wild swings mm-hmm. that can happen inside, because my studio's in a garage, so, you know, I mean, it can get pretty warm in here. So it protects it. It's not climate controlled by any means. But then on my beer fridge, my kegerator, mm-hmm. I've got the bottom drawer set on, which would be the freezer, but it has a temp controller so that I can keep my more expensive or my, you know, more delicate beers in there. So, you know, maybe my Sierra Nevada Anchor Steam is sitting up here, but I've got my brewery beers in my refrigerator.
What upsets me the most is are the nice bottles like these that say store at 50 degrees to 55 degrees. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, I have some wine boxes that go under my bed.
Right.
And I hope it stays around that temperature.
Well, the wine boxes that have the cells in them,
mm-hmm.
the styrofoam cells, do a fantastic job of keeping that. I mean, I've done plenty of cross-country trips where in the back of the van, and we're driving across the desert, it's 115 degrees, and the beer in the cells, it's packed under everything. And I pull it out when I get home, and
they're fine.
Yeah, you know, it's room temperature in there, but it could be so much worse,
oh, yeah.
you know. And so those cells do a lot, and just by blocking it off or closing it off, you can really protect the beer. You know, it's dark in there, and protected from the wild temperature swings, which is really what kills it. You know, especially it, like this sour here. If there was any yeast in there or any wild bugs, a temperature spike will wake them up, right. Start chewing everything out. You end up, you know.
You know, honestly, that, you know, I tried to keep it the best I could. I threw it in the fridge last night.
I wouldn't have been able to tell any difference. I mean, this is, there isn't anything in here that, other than what I would expect to be coming out of the beer. I mean, so mm-hmm. I think your whatever process you have for keeping it is working just fine.
There's a method to my madness.
So the beer issue, mm-hmm. when is the publication
the
date on
that? The beer issue publication is October 24th. I'm looking to do a special 5 o'clock somewhere. I don't know if it's going to be for that particular issue, but it's going to be about my trip to the UK. Probably talk about real ales, cask ales, and stuff at BrewDog. It's going to be a cool issue. I'm really glad to be a part of it.
All right. Well, what do you say we call quits and find a pretzel or two to eat?
Sounds good to me. I could definitely use a pretzel or two. Okay. So long, everybody on the internet.